The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Based on that, so without further ado, Regina Johnson.
Thanks, everybody. So I don't have a lot of props for this talk, but I do have a Kleenex, because a lot of this stuff makes me angry like it does all of you. So I'm also a little bit nervous, so. Yeah. So as has been discussed throughout the weekend, we are living during a global crisis. There are 3 billion people in the world today who live on less than $2 a day. A billion of those people live on less than a dollar a day. Before the current food crisis, 854 million people were suffering from hunger and malnourishment. 300 million of those are children. The growing numbers and size of slums throughout the world have typified this poverty. A third of the global population, one-third, live in slums. 6% of the urban population and 78.2% of the urban population in underdeveloped countries. Most live without clean water, sewage systems, and decent infrastructure. The current global food crisis has escalated what was already a dire situation for many. Another 100 million people may be added soon to the list of people living on less than just $2 a day. People living on $2 a day already were spending half of their incomes on food. Food inflation has caused staple foods to be out of reach for many in the world, as the price of grain has risen by 42%, rice by 74%, and dairy products by 80%. The already devastating circumstances of the world's working poor has forced people to the streets in protest, not in violence, because I actually call this violence. In Egypt, Haiti, Mexico, and others, with people having to come up with inventive food mixtures that don't necessarily include food. Places like Haiti, where they're eating biscuits mixed with dirt. As people are starving, people are also living under occupation and war, with daily bombings in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine. At least 1.2 million people have died as a result of this war and occupation already. Millions more have been turned into refugees, adding to the world's growing slum population. Wars not only create massive human catastrophes, but irreversible destruction to the environment. Over 1,200 tons of depleted uranium has been used in Iraq so far, 3 times the amount that was used in the 1991 Gulf War. Uranium-238 remains radioactive for millions of years. Like, is that comprehensible? Military spending rose globally last year to $1.3 trillion. I don't even think these numbers are accurate, given that the U.S. military has spent $800 billion on the Iraq War. And as if things couldn't get any worse, global warming continues to rise, threatening the capacity for human life to exist on this very planet. 11 of the last 12 years ranked the hottest amongst since 1850, so the last 150 years. We see ice caps melting, we see hurricanes, droughts, cyclones in Myanmar, floods, the massive floods that are going on, tornadoes, wildfires. And in most of our cities, we already have experienced massive shifts and changes in the temperatures. Global biodiversity is being severely impacted as well. An estimated 150 species of plants and animals already disappear each day due to climate change. John Bellamy Foster talked about 72 species dying a day just 5 years ago. And an increase of just 2% or 2 degrees Fahrenheit could mean 30% of the species on the Earth risk of extinction. And the latest animal to be added to the endangered species list is the polar bear. The polar bear, which relies on sea ice to catch seals, could be driven to extinction from global warming in 100 years. Arctic sea ice is melting at a rate of up to 9% per decade, and it is possible that Arctic summers could be ice-free by mid-century. So yes, the world is in crisis. We live in a time of spreading wars for resources, poverty, and global warming. People are angry and upset, and we're all looking for something to do about this. But are Americans to blame? Does our consumption create the ills of the world? Are we part of the solution? If we change our lifestyle, stop driving cars, eating fast food, buy locally, will we reverse the course of global warming and the endless war for resources and the poverty that we see today? I'm going to attempt to answer these questions by looking at the system itself. modern capitalism, a system where a minority of the world's population, roughly 1%, the ruling classes, the owners of corporations and factories, strive for profit at the expense of the destruction of our lives, workers' lives, the people who produce the profit in the first place. An exploitative class system that I believe is actually responsible for wreaking the havoc on the world and the destruction we see today to human life and to the planet. A system at the same time that actually has the ability to feed and house and clothe the whole world if production and distribution lay in our hands, the very people who create the wealth in the first place. But first, I want to look at what it's really like for the majority of Americans. Looking at the real conditions of the way that people live here in the United States actually leads us in the right direction of looking at consumption and how the majority of waste actually doesn't come from U.S. workers. But first, it's important to note, the average North American does consume 40%, 40 times the amount of energy than a person in an underdeveloped country. Energy consumption per person in advanced capitalist countries, not just here in the United States, but all advanced capitalist countries, is 80 times that as sub-Saharan Africa. This country is 5% of the world's population, but uses 25% of the world's energy and produces 22% of carbon dioxide from industrial processes, causing global warming. So many people look at these numbers and come up with a solution that says we should just consume less and we should recycle more. These ideas, though, aren't based on a class analysis of our system, what role capitalist production has in consumption and waste. These solutions also don't look at the reality of what it's like to live here in the United States right now, if you can actually call it living at all. The creation of pollution and the vast majority of energy is consumed by production and distribution, not by individual consumers. For every pound of household waste, there is another 70 pounds of waste created by industries such as mining, manufacturing, agriculture, and petrochemicals. So the vast majority of waste is actually not created by individual consumers, but by choices made behind factory doors with profit as the bottom line decision maker. And recycling actually does nothing to ameliorate this waste that's actually created from production, the contamination that is put out there in our environment during the production process in the first place. The corporate media and government does everything it can do to sow lies that Americans are obese and we're living the high life. Marxist ideas are up against mainstream ideas that push personal responsibility on an ever-increasing scale, aka we're all to blame. So shut off your lights, buy organic foods, and drive hybrid cars. How many of you can afford to buy a hybrid car? And I'll probably get to this in a sec, but this is a lovely book. There's many of them out there that, you know, wonderful people like Robert Redford and Will Ferrell and Jennifer Aniston tells us how to consume less. So there's some lovely choice quotes, so we'll see if I get to those. But the reality is that most people in the world and here in the United States don't consume enough. According to the Census Bureau, in the richest country in the world, at least 12.3%, that is 37.9 million people, one in eight people here in the United States live in poverty. And these rates are even worse for people of color because of institutionalized racism. 21.8% of black families and 19.5% of Latino families experience food insecurity at a far higher rate than national average. The Census Bureau has gloated over the last couple of years about how this percentage rate has actually gone down for poverty in the United States. But they actually don't tell us that these numbers about the cost of living is actually based on cost of living from 1963. So are there any math majors in here? You know how? Okay, yeah, it's 45 years. So as defined by the Office of Management, the average poverty threshold for a family of four in 2006 was $20,614, four people. For a family of three, it was $16,079. For a family of two, $13,167. And for an individual, $10,294. So as all those gasps, these numbers are horrifically low. I really can't imagine anyone being able to clothe, feed, and house a family with this income, let alone an individual in most cities. considering the high cost of living, skyrocketing food prices, gas being over $4 a gallon, people losing their housing, medical care becoming a luxury item, not to mention childcare in the United States, which we don't really talk about. These numbers in no way reflect the reality that there are millions more living in poverty and are just one paycheck behind from living in the streets. 17.6% of children live in poverty in the United States. We have the largest poverty rate amongst children in developed countries. So I ask you all, are American lives immune from this crisis? The majority is not. As the unemployment rate jumped to 5.5% in May, the highest since 1986, the news and the mainstream media is finally starting to talk about the heartbreaking stories of working class people and unemployed families going to soup kitchens and pantries, and demand is up 15 to 20% from last year. And I want to tell a story that illustrates this. I was in Houston in May visiting friends, and one of my friends that's a teacher there in the Houston schools, she told me how in the cafeteria there's actually a sign up that says family members cannot eat off of the trays of their children because families have been compensating eating by going and eating lunches with their kids at school. And as Sharon Smith describes in the last ISR, as job losses mount in the current recession, an unprecedented 28 million Americans are expected to receive food stamps to survive this year. One in six people in West Virginia and one in 10 in Ohio and New York are now relying on food stamps to survive. And one in three children in Oklahoma have been on food stamps at least some point last year. So this is happening at the same time as the government actually cut donation to food banks. In an article titled "Charities Forced to Do More with Less," Jean Daniel, a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, said, "The federal government donated $242 million in surplus food to food banks, soup kitchens, and emergency shelters in 2003. Last year, it donated $58 million, so a quarter of the amount, in surplus food to the same places. The federal government's food donations didn't decline because it decided to provide less. It declined because the American agricultural industry is experiencing strong sales and record exports." So there is a myth that American workers are all white, middle-class males who make $100,000 a year, right? The U.S. working class is multiracial. They are undocumented workers who are threatened with being rounded up in the middle of the night, separated from children, and locked in detention centers. The working class is the people who work at Walmart as they're being locked in for poverty wages. The working class are also the auto workers who are seeing cuts to their jobs and cuts to their pay. They are the soldiers who are returning from Iraq without medical care as they suffer from PTSD. Death row and prisons are filled with working class people whose crime was that they were poor, did not have access to a good lawyer, health care, and jobs. And many inmates in prison are actually being forced slave labor to work. They also are not fed enough. The amount of calories that they're given would not even feed a child. So the working class is also multigendered. And yes, it is not all heterosexual. And all workers in the United States are not even housed. Approximately 3.5 million people in the United States are homeless. Mike Davis describes this factor in Planet of Slums. The fact that the United States is listed in Planet of Slums is an indication. Quote, "Los Angeles is the first world capital of homelessness, with 100,000 homeless people, 100,000, including an increasing number of families camped on downtown streets or living in parks and amongst freeway landscaping." The media and government try to hide these shocking statistics by changing names from hunger to food insecurity. And now they're trying to redefine who is considered homeless. At the same time as the homeless population is growing, there's a crisis of overproduction of homes, meaning they are not able to sell houses for a profit. Not because people don't need them, as I just described. Homes are built under this system not to house people, but to make money. 450,000 mortgage loans went into foreclosure from January to March. Another 3 million households are behind in payment. Families saw what little savings they had in their homes vanish. The working class has had a negative savings in the last couple of years, and many are forced to buy groceries and basic necessities on their credit cards. Remember this when they talk about all the debt that we get on our credit cards. And people have to choose from paying gas, being able to actually go to work, feeding their children, and paying rent right now. And I want to give you an example. I grew up in a small town of 2,500 people, an industrial town, and there are no longer any grocery stores in this town. Right now, my mother has to drive a car that's 15 years old, I'm sorry, actually 35 years old, gets 15 miles to the gallon, so she has to drive 30 miles to go get groceries right now. Gas in her town is $4.89 a gallon, which means to buy groceries, my mother has to spend $20 just to go and buy groceries. The median household income in the United States is $48,200, which may seem like a lot when taking in the fact that actually a lot of people in the world live on less than $2 a day, until you look at all the factors I just described. In San Francisco, there was a study done a few years ago that a person would have to make $20 an hour to barely afford to live in the city and barely afford to feed themselves and barely afford to get around. This was not even including health care. So that would equal $38,200 a year. People work 320 more hours in the United States than our friends in Europe. Real wages compared to inflation have not increased for 30 years, as productivity actually has gone up for the working class here. So the standard of living for working class people has gone down drastically, and the gap between rich and poor is only increasing. And the rich barely seem to notice that just outside their doors, people are dying and they're starving, as they make decisions that are based on competition over markets and resources. These are the Americans who are destroying the world, benefiting off of the misery and the poverty in the United States and abroad. And there are many examples. I had to cut them out of my talk. It's too long. But I'll list a couple of very grotesque examples here. At the same time as prices have risen for foodstuff around the world, corporations tied to the agribusiness industry have literally made killer profits. Not because there isn't enough food to go around. Production of food has actually increased over the last few years, and it has outpaced population growth. But because capitalism forces scarcity in order to keep profits high. Cargill, a privately held multinational agricultural corporation, yes, which would actually rank in the top 20 companies in the Fortune 500 if it was a public company, reported the first quarter profits in 2008 were 86% higher than in the same period in 2007. And this is what Greg Page, Cargill's chairman and chief executive officer, had to say. Quote, demand for food in developing economies and for energy worldwide is boosting demand for agricultural goods, at the same time that investment monies have been streamed into commodity markets. Prices are setting new highs, and markets are extraordinarily volatile. In this environment, Cargill's team has done an exceptional job measuring and assessing price risk and managing the large volume of grains, oilseeds, and other commodities, moving them through our supply chains for customers globally. And Page is not alone in his exploitation of the current economic crisis. In an article titled, Despite Tough Times, Ultra Rich Keeps Spending. Okay. There might be more of those. Be prepared. Okay. From April, the authors report how some businesses that cater to the super rich, many of them traders and private equity investors whose work is tied to Wall Street, are splurging on multi-million dollar Manhattan homes, custom-built yachts, contemporary art, and lavish parties. The article starts with, quote, who said anything about a recession? Sometime between the government bailout of Bear Stearns and the Bureau of Labor Statistics reporting that America had lost 80,000 jobs in March, Lee Tachman spent roughly $50,000 last month on a four-day jaunt to Miami for himself and his three close friends. So remember how I just said that the average, you know, yearly wage of workers is about that same amount? Yeah, this jerk spent that much in 4 days. Then last October, millionaire Mark Spierling, the 36-year-old president of an equity trading company, said this about working people losing their homes. Quote, I don't want to sound harsh, But the people who were buying million-dollar houses with a combined household income of $70,000, $80,000 were the ones who were chasing easy money. Yeah. This goes on to show that John Paulson, who made $3.7 billion last year by betting against mortgages and complex financial products that held them, wasn't the only one who benefited off of the end of the American dream. But the ruling class in the United States is not alone in benefiting from poverty and misery of working people all over the world. Mukesh Ambani, head of Mumbai, India-based petrochemical giant Reliance Industries, the fifth richest man in the world, has recently become the proud owner of the first $2 billion dollar home. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Quote, it's a 27-story skyscraper in downtown Mumbai. The Ambani home, called Antilla, like, you know it's bad when you got a name for your home. Like, what am I going to name my studio? Okay. I'll call it a pebble. No. Differs in that no two floors are alike in either plans or materials used. At the request of Nita Ambani, if a metal, wood, or crystal is part... Crystal! In your house! is part of the ninth floor design, it shouldn't be used on the 11th floor, for example. The ideal is to... Yeah, it's absurd. The idea... The idea is to blend styles and architectural elements so spaces give the feel of consistency but without repetition. Yeah, it gets more disgusting because this is India, where 65% of the population lives on 33 cents a day. Just in case any of you are wondering if you are rich enough to be in the ruling class, ready? Take advice of Forbes in an article titled, "When Are You Seriously Rich?" by Paul Johnson. So this is the fun part of my talk. Okay, quote, in an age of richless, what exactly do we mean by rich? In the current English usage, it's not enough to say someone is rich, but he must be seriously rich. But what constitutes serious wealth? One magnate I know lays it down like this. If you know exactly how much you're worth, you're not seriously rich. I've heard figures like 100 million mentioned. 50 million is too low, they say. So, you know, some of us were joking around about the fact that we don't know how much we're in debt. So we're like... Yeah. Seriously, Dad. Okay. Yeah. So, are rich people just greedy bastards who have no moral courage to share their wealth? Yes. Yes. But it's the capitalist system as a whole we have to point to. It's not just about trying to change minds of rich people. How the rich spend their money and where the working class spends its money is not the solution. Our choices don't even compare to the impact of the choices made by the ruling class. In fact, I would argue they actually don't matter. Except for when we struggle, that part. According to John Bellamy Foster, quote, every day 1 million tons of hazardous waste is generated in the world, 90% of them in the industrialized world. On an average day in the US, there are 5 industrial accidents involving hazardous waste. By far, the most physical waste is generated by production, not consumption. For every ton at the consumer end of the waste stream, there are likely to have been 20 tons in initial resource extraction and 5 tons produced in manufacturing. As the capitalist system developed, destruction to human life and the environment has always been key in its never-ending search for profits. Along with the environment and natural resources, labor was turned into a commodity to be bought and sold as needed on the market. Capitalists actually need to force open global markets to sell their commodities through the direct use of military intervention and the use of financial systems. And as Marxists, we call this imperialism. Wars are fought to take over the world's remaining natural resources and to make sure markets are open to corporations to sell the commodities made from these resources, which they have stolen. State borders are set up to control the flow of goods at any given government's discretion, at the influence of corporations. In other words, states are set up to protect the property of the rich. Think of how easily bombs cross borders, yet people cannot. Tariffs and economic barriers are placed to help control local economies. And I want to give the example of the Iraq War and the current food crisis to go into this a bit more. There is a myth that we as consumers control the market through supply and demand. Take, for instance, the war in Iraq. Common myth is that Bush went to Iraq to secure oil for U.S. consumers, as you just mentioned. Even oil corporations repeat these lies when trying to explain their record profits and $4 a gallon gas prices. Therefore, the solution could be that if we just all ride bikes and use fuel-efficient cars, eventually we'll leave Iraq. With my mother aside, who has to, you know, drive 30 miles to buy groceries. But the end goal in Iraq is to use oil as an economic and political wedge against countries that actually rely on these resources. The U.S. buys only 13% of its oil from the Middle East. Japan imports 85%. India and China actually project rapid increases in the need for energy in the future. So it's not that U.S. corporations want to control the oil for our consumption. Most importantly, they want to have control over selling oil to Asia and Europe. The U.S. buys most of its oil from South America and Canada. And Europe and Asia buy the majority of their oil from the Middle East. So looking at the current global food crisis, which is a crisis of neoliberalism that has been carried out through the economic wing of U.S. imperialism. The quest for profit through the economic model forced countries who once produced their own food locally to go to cash crops and produce for export. They were forced to lower tariffs for corporations to infiltrate their markets. Countries who are rich in natural resources can no longer feed their people because big corporations who want to make profits in the first place through exporting and selling their resources to the highest bidder. And it's not just U.S. corporations. Think of what's going on in Haiti right now. The Mevs, one of the wealthiest families in Haiti, bought the Haitian American Sugar Company, or HASCO, in order to become the major importer of sugar to Haiti. And hunger exists not because there isn't enough food, but because of the way that food is produced and distributed. In a quote from the Socialist Worker, the UN reports that enough food was grown last year to give every single person on the planet 2,800 calories per day, enough to make them overweight. By 2030, with the population growth continuing to decline as agricultural output rises, the UN predicts an estimated population of 8.3 billion people could receive 3,050 calories a day. Hunger is manufactured and famines are created by the ruling class. In a great book called Stuffed and Starved by Raj Patel, which I really recommend everybody gets, we're out of it already here. Sorry. Thanks for blaming me. See what happens? Okay, Raj Patel uses the example of the Bengal famine for this point. Quote, 3 million people died during famine. At the same time as people died of hunger, there was enough food in Bengal to be able to feed them. In fact, there was plenty of it around. It's just that those who own it hoarded it, knowing less food meant higher prices. Those who died in the streets did so because they simply weren't able to pay enough for the food locked up in granaries. Consumption is cultivated. The expropriation of resources from other countries and colonies has always been linked to imperialism, and in turn, the forcing of consumption of those resources internationally. At the same time as capitalists were using the military to steal resources abroad, they were trying to figure out new ways for us to consume here at home. The question of consumption is intimately tied to the rise of monopoly capitalism, which I want to go through a little bit. Americans are conceived as being fat, lazy, television-watching machines. We drive big SUVs, we're wasteful, we lack culture, we're individualistic, and we only strive for the bottom line, money. In fact, throughout my life, my father always told me money makes the world go round. And I would be like, no, Dad, I'm gonna marry for love or whatever. And he would be like, no, you know. Gotta figure out a way to make money. So me being an artist didn't really help with that. But anyways, hopefully I've broken down a lot of these myths already and been able to help direct the finger of judgment and condemnation in the right direction. The rich who do consume too much are lazy in the system itself. But now I want to explain how the American lifestyle became what it is today. It's important that we have a deeper understanding of the historical situation in which we've arrived in order to have a more nuanced argument for the people who argue for lifestyle politics and who blame working class consumers for our lives that now revolve around the dollar. The rise of monopoly capitalism changed the way the family fulfilled its role. It used to be that the family used to be a place where the immediate needs were produced, such as food, clothing, toys, and games. And as these things were brought into the commodity market, alienation deepened. And I invite people to listen to Kristen's talk yesterday around the theory of alienation and go to Larry Bradshaw's talk tomorrow on capitalism to understand this more. But alienation came out of capitalism as workers were separated from what we produced and how we produced it by selling our labor. Relationships became centered around buying and selling commodities. Relationship within families, friends, our interaction with the community, caring for elderly, all began to suffer. And care for each other actually became institutionalized. Even free time, the time that we spend outside of work, becomes a commodity, another way for them to make profit. When people try to find cost-free ways to reconnect with nature, do sports activities, go and see art, the capitalist finds a way to intercept. Therefore, everything in life continues to be for sale, affecting how we see each other. Mm-hmm. We become identified with objects, what we wear, what we eat, what kind of car we drive. As handmade goods became a derogatory word, and as store-bought actually became a sense of status. What makes us happy is now intimately tied to buying something new. Monopoly capitalism, commodity expansion, paired with neoliberal attacks on schools, which I invite everyone to get the CD of Elizabeth's talk, has meant that working class kids now go to public schools without access to learning creative expression. Art programs, music, sports, metal shops, they've all been cut from funding. Now kids are actually less likely to know what they do and what makes them happy, separate from entertainment devices. Harry Braverman talks about this really well. He said, quote, "The inhabitant of capitalist society is enmeshed in a wave made up of commodity goods and commodity services from which there is little possibility of escape, except through partial or total abstention from social life as it exists now." When you think about all this, the more it makes sense that we use Nintendos, Game Boys, internet chat rooms, online dating, all of that stuff. There's many examples. Monopoly capitalism turned everything into our lives into a commodity. And as part of this, nature became exploited as well. Taylorism, which is actually used to describe how labor became systematized and to maximize profit, that was also applied to nature. And creativity and diversity and adaptability was crushed. Natural complexity of forest habitats was replaced by artificial simplicity of industrial tree plantation. Industries that have destroyed natural habitats of bugs, fungus, animals, and also polluted streams, not to mention increasing devastation that we see happening now with rapid rainfall and the melt, you know, from the, you know, the melt from the mountains. Monopoly capitalism meant the rise in the use of synthetics and plastics, causing a great impact on the earth as had not been seen before. To quote John Bellamy Foster, he says, "The technological displacement of nature can be seen in a substitution of artificial fertilizers for organic fertilizers, the development of pesticides to replace biological forms of insect control, the use of synthetics and plastics instead of materials occurring in nature, such as cotton, wood, wool, and iron, and the replacement of soap by detergents with high phosphate content." So all the things that are naturally biodegradable in our world. And there had to be a place that was created to sell all these new products. Consumption was forced through the creation of the supermarket. Did any of you guys know that? This part's very fascinating. The vast majority of people prior to World War I bought food at local groceries. They would go up to the counter with a list of their groceries, and they would ask them, and they would take them out of bulk bins, and then they would give them to them. This changed drastically as the United States officially entered the war, as food prices climbed by 19% and food riots were occurring in the United States in Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. Grocers felt the pressure to cut costs. Again, according to Raj Patel, he talks about Clarence Saunders, who opened the first Piggly Wiggly store in Memphis, Tennessee. In it, he codified the key retail revolution that was to ripple throughout the 20th century. It all turns on transforming the relationship between buyer and seller in a way that cut retail costs to the bone, a.k.a. labor. In his words, quote, in Mr. Piggly Wiggly's words, quote, "The object of my said invention is to provide a store equipment by which the customer will be enabled to serve himself, and in doing so will be required to review the entire assortment of goods carried in stock, conveniently and attractively displayed. And after selecting the list of goods desired, will be required to pass a checking and paying station at which the goods selected may be billed, packed, and settled before retiring from the store, thus relieving the store of a large proportion of the usual incidental expenses or overhead charges required to operate it." Raj Patel calls this the first consumption factory. Consumers were forced to go through stores like rats in a maze. They only could go in one side and they had to exit the other. Just seriously a maze. And were influenced to put as much as they could into their cart as possible, being forced to travel through the whole store even if you had milk. Only had to get milk. Through time, this maze has been modified, but incidentally, the idea that milk is placed in the back of the store now is actually no coincidence. And also the way the store switches around merchandise and confuses us and makes us walk around, that's also on purpose. This realization does not compute with the logic that Americans just love to consume. If this were the case, retail stores wouldn't have to push around, you know, confuse us and put merchandise everywhere in the store, forcing us all the time to buy something new. The Piggly Wiggly store put the wheel in motion of what was later to become normalcy of everyday life, fast food, online retailing, and self-service. Even the way in which music, color, and smells are studied as a way to figure out how to encourage us to buy more while shopping can be dated back to the Piggly Wiggly store. That name's so funny. I heard that maybe there is a Piggly Wiggly store somewhere still. That's really funny. Okay, but some Americans are not even lucky enough to have a supermarket in their neighborhood. It has been researched that when there are supermarkets in poorer neighborhoods, there is less obesity amongst the population. In general, poor people pay more for food, are forced to shop at corner stores, and buy food at fast food restaurants. In the Bay Area, for example, Emeryville is home to Pixar Campus and happens to have an immense amount of retail stores and shopping chains. Right close by West Oakland, which is a working-class neighborhood and has 30,000 residents, there are 36 convenience stores and liquor stores. And guess how many supermarkets? One. Raj Patel explains a connection between obesity and choice as such. We are encouraged to understand obesity to be, at the end of the day, an individual failing, an inability to deal with the fargo of choices offered to us, a deficit of impulse control. Conventional wisdom see obesity as a symptom of impoverished faculty of choice, never a result of impoverished range of choices. $10 billion a year is spent to market food to children in the United States. Think of these numbers as you remember that adult onset diabetes has recently been renamed type 2 because diabetes is now so prevalent in children. Poor people also lack open green spaces, parks, and public playgrounds that would lower a child's susceptibility to disease related to obesity. Then waste, like supermarkets, becomes a mode of consumption under modern capitalism. Sanitation engineering was developed after World War II. Because it was less costly and outperformed other disposal techniques such as incinerators and reprocessing plants. The normal procedure, which had been done throughout generations of actually sorting and reusing and recycling goods, then became less efficient and more expensive to perform. After World War I, the U.S. emerged with the most efficient production lines developed, along with a population with unparalleled purchasing power. The war stimulated the post-war mass production and consumption boom. At the same time as the U.S. was mastering efficient means of disposing new types and ever-growing quantities of waste, One marketing consultant explained it at the time, quote, "Our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life. We need things consumed, burned up, worn out, replaced, discarded on an ever-increasing pace." For the first time, products were made to be thrown away, broken, and replaced. Think of your computer now that basically will work 5 years and it mysteriously breaks. Or your car that then breaks and becomes too expensive to fix. Or other electronic devices. All these goods would now be marketed on a mass scale as never been seen before. Coming out of World War II, obsolescence became a new term for products. Even clothing, the idea of seasons and fads, had to be manufactured to get people to constantly feel as if what we were wearing was too old, out of date. Old. But people naturally want to reuse products. Consumers get blamed for our laziness and that we just love to buy new things. But this is just not the case. When options are given to reuse and recycle bottles in an easy way throughout the world, people actually do it in very large percentages. And yes, even here in the United States. In the 1970s, when the first return bottle was passed in Oregon, the return rate was over 90%. At the same time as refillables were being cycled out, locally owned grocery stores were being phased out of the market because refillable containers drove up store costs. The idea of packaging became a source of profit for corporations. If customers were forced to pay for new packaging all the time, this cost would be passed along to the consumer and would generate more profit for corporations. As Heather Rogers notes in the Conquest of Garbage article, quote, "The story demonstrates the logic of our economic system. It externalizes costs onto the environment and to individual consumers through the disposal of garbage, but also through increased resource extraction, manufacturing, and distribution to make and sell replacement goods as a means of keeping up with consumption and profit high, as a means of keeping consumption and profits high." So placing blame on consumers for waste and destruction to the environment is vital for corporations and the government because it keeps our gaze and anger away from the root causes of the actual problem. We should not blame ourselves or other working people or poor people for the ways in which decisions around production are made at the expense of people's lives, health, and the environment. So what can we do? Oftentimes people look at the horrors of the world and want to try and just escape. They rightfully don't want to contribute to the problem. There are romantic myths of beautiful and poetic harmony about the way that we interacted with the environment prior to the Industrial Revolution. Oftentimes, they disregard the ecological history, though, of humanity, which in turn leads to arguments around the need for us to go back to easier days where people were tilling the land, eating what they grew, waking with the sun, stopping work when you feel like it, and then spending time with friends. But the reality really wasn't that romantic. As described by John Bellamy Foster, quote, "The history of pre-capitalist and pre-industrial societies is full of examples of social collapse brought on by environmental depredations. Historical and archaeological evidence suggests that the Sumerian, Indus Valley, Greek, Phoenician, Roman, Mayan civilizations all collapsed due in part to ecological factors. The conditions of the peasantry, which comprised the bulk of the world's population prior to the Industrial Revolution, was characterized by high infant mortality, low life expectancy, severe undernourishment, the threat of famines and epidemics, hardly a miraculous accommodation with nature." We can't actually expect to escape the reality of the world we live in. Corporations, as I just described, have infiltrated every part of our life. The military-industrial complex is one example I can't go into. But even though capitalism has created all this destruction, we also have for the first time in human history the possibility to feed the world and make existence on this planet better than the past, with all the modern inventions of science and technology. Capitalism created the very force that has the ability to make a better society through our collective struggle. Workers, through our socialized labor, have the ability to stop production, to take wealth, the wealth we produce from the hands of the capitalists and turn it over to the vast majority of the world's population. We do have the ability to house and feed the whole world. The question is how to go about achieving this goal. Corporations and the ruling class are working every day together to destroy the planet. How can we expect to change this if we continue to work separate from each other? For the vast majority of people in the world, they are already forced to conserve energy, water, and food because they can't afford it in the first place. The majority of the people drive cars because this country does not have adequate public transportation systems, thanks to the oil and car industry. Given these facts, individual solutions around consumption end up being elitist. Who can choose to make these life choices? Only people who have time and money can choose to change their lifestyle. And again, as I just described, individual solutions actually do nothing to change how commodities are produced and distributed under capitalism. But people do turn to individualism also because there is no visible environmental justice movement right now. But as I just laid out in this talk, the fate of the environment is tied to the ruling class's ability to wage wars and destroy working people's lives in the pursuit of their endless profits. Therefore, fighting to end wars and fighting for justice for workers, both documented and not, is connected to the fight to save the planet. As John Bellamy Foster says pointedly in The Vulnerable Planet, quote, "War, economic inequality, and third world underdevelopment are inextricably bound to the larger question of the systematic degradation of the planet and the conditions of life for the majority of the world's people. The failure to perceive this connection is the principal weakness of mainstream environmentalism. If we are to make sense of the environmental crisis, we must not abandon radical change, but broaden and deepen them to take into account the destruction of the earth itself. It is above all this interconnectedness of social and environmental problems that constitutes the primary basis upon which a potent movement can be created. This system is banking on alienation and ideas around individual responsibility, along with racism, sexism, and homophobia to keep us apart. I think we should do everything in our power to keep fighting together against this system that chooses profit margins over the needs of the majority of the people in the world and the planet. The majority of people in this country are not the problem, and it's our job to win them as allies in collective struggle."
This is a great talk. I just want to point people's attention to a couple of books that were mentioned during the talk. Mike Davis, Planet of Slums, John Bellamy Foster, Ecology versus Capitalism, and then also Marx's Ecology. Another book that Regina mentioned in her talk that I don't know, it might be available upstairs in the Haymarket Room. If not, I think it's available on the website, is Labor and Monopoly Capital by Harry Braverman. I highly recommend that people...
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.